From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation this week. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of science fiction's most respected writers, Samuel R. Delaney. Delaney's novels, such as Dahlgren and the Navarian series, are considered sci-fi classics. Delaney's just written a memoir about his early writing days in New York City's East Village. Also today, I speak with novelist Don DeLillo. In his new novel, Libra, he imagines a conspiracy of coincidence that led Lee Harvey Oswald to assassinate President Kennedy. Guest book critic Stuart Klawans reviews works by African writer Amos Tutuola. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles the late Eddie Cochran, who gave the world the hit Summertime Blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Science fiction writer Samuel Delaney immediately explodes any preconceptions we might form of him. He grew up in Harlem's middle class, the son of a mortician. He attended the Bronx High School of Science for gifted students, despite his severe dyslexia. And though he married poet Marilyn Hacker while he was still in his teens, he's a very outspoken gay man. He worked as a folk singer, too, once with a bigger billing than newcomer Bob Dylan. Delaney has written close to 20 science fiction books, including Babel 17, Dahlgren, and the Navarian series. He's also written analyses of the language used in science fiction, and he's credited with introducing many stylistic innovations into the form. Delaney's work explores the cultural, sexual, linguistic, and aesthetic biases that control our lives. Samuel Delaney has just written a memoir entitled The Motion of Light in Water, Sex and Science Fiction Writing in the East Village, 1957 to 1965. When he first sat down to write science fiction, he took it on almost as a challenge.
I'd been having discussions with Marilyn, who at that point was working as an assistant editor at Ace Books, that published a great deal of science fiction, and we'd been having all these discussions about the science fiction novels that she was editing, and she had a great many criticisms of them, and one of the impetuses behind the book was to write a book that would take care of some of these things, and so in that sense the book was kind of written before her. It also grew out of a whole set of rather troubling dreams that I was having at the time. It was shortly after we were married, I wanted the book to be science fiction. I am not one of the people who there are some writers who say take down all the barriers and make it a real adventure for the reader walking into the bookstore. But I think that's kind of counterproductive.
How much of your writing is generated by dreams?
Not terribly much. A scene here or a single idea there. I can point to maybe four or five places in an oeuvre that now contains about 16 or 17 novels or novel-length works of fiction, and maybe four or five scenes, out of all of that. Not usually whole books.
You were occasionally rubbing shoulders with literary lions of the time in the village. You tell a very amusing story of having W.H. Auden over for a dinner of shrimp curry with red wine in
yes.
a sweltering apartment.
And another ghastly juxtapositions, yes.
Well, I bet. I mean, you were, what, 18, playing
right,
host with Marilyn?
Yeah.
Did the topic of science fiction come up that evening?
At one point it did. Marilyn had given some poems to Auden, and basically the evening was very much hers, because they had discussed her poetry, and poetry was the topic of the night. But at one point, very politely, Auden turned to me and said, "And what do you do?" And so I answered back, "Well, I scribble science fiction to survive." And that was when I was in the middle of writing the what eventually became my first science fiction novel. The only thing at the time, one, nobody had bought the book, nobody had even read it, nor was it finished. So the notion of surviving through doing this was really something of a bit of wish fulfillment on my part. I also, sort of as soon as I heard myself say it, and indeed Auden then turned to Chester Kallman, who was with us that evening, and said, he scribbles science fiction to survive. And when I heard the words come back to me, they sounded just awful. And I sort of turned red to the cheeks and sat there feeling really strange for the rest of the evening. There was some relief in it a couple of years later when I discovered in The Age of Anxiety, Auden's book-length poem. He says that, you know, human beings are creatures who cannot be anything without pretending to be at first. But that, I think, was the moment in which I was pretending to be a science fiction writer and learned that maybe my notion of the pretense was not the best way to do it.
My guest here on Fresh Air today is science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. Your book is subtitled Sex and Science Fiction, Writing in the East Village, 1957 to 1965. What for you was important about writing about these two subjects in your memoirs?
Well, I think during that time, perhaps the dates more accurately should have been 1960 to 1965, but nevertheless, I think during those years there were large changes changes of attitude both towards art in general and towards sex in particular. You hear a lot of talk of sexual revolution the whole sort of underpinnings of art that that eventually necessitated a term like postmodernism. At this point these were becoming material forces that were actually changing the way people thought about art, their bodies, and their lives. So these are kinds of some of the topics of this particular book, the occasion for which is a kind of autobiographical memoir.
You write throughout the book about being, I guess, very much a marginal person at the time. You were black, you were gay, you were extremely bright, you'd gone to Bronx Science School, and what that means you had an IQ of over 140.
And well, that was the average IQ. There were people who had IQs substantially less, and people with IQs substantially more.
And you were a writer, so clearly you transcended a lot of borders, and you also weren't easily fit into any of the so-called normal categories. You seem to view this, your place in the world, with a great deal of humor.
Well, I think it's an education. What happens, I think, if you are in any of those categories is, if you're in more than one of those categories, certainly what happens is you begin to, you get the ordinary view of the world, but you also get a marginal view as well. People tend to assume, I think, somehow that anyone in any one of those categories only has the marginal view. Well, you have to develop what the writer, the black writer, Du Bois, called a kind of double vision, which allows you to see things more or less from the view of the center, even if you don't inhabit that place yourself, because if you don't understand it fairly well, you literally don't survive. On the other hand, you have a kind of critical stance from which to view that, quote, center, unquote, and critique it from. So you do get this kind of double vision of things. If you happen to belong to all three categories, black, gay, and an artist as well, then you have three margins from which to critique the center, and the center stops looking so central at that point.
Well, it seems that science fiction is an ideal outlet to write about this, because science fiction in many ways is about transcending boundaries of all kinds, stepping into other times, imagining universes where there are hermaphrodite characters and other forms of sexuality. Is this part of what appealed to you about writing science fiction?
Well, at the time I started, there wasn't a great deal of that. The notion that a genre, just because it's on the edge itself and is a marginal genre itself, has a innate sympathy to things marginal is not necessarily the case. In fact, I think what you're more likely to get the beginning of marginal genres is a kind of insecurity, the insecurity that frequently breeds at the margin and an attempt to cling even closer to an imagined center. A good deal of science fiction, certainly the most popular science fiction, especially at that time, tended to be distressingly right-wing in its general view of things.
Was this in part because of a fascination with technology and technocracy?
I don't think it was technology per se. I think it was just that there was a, on the one hand, well, let me see if we can sort of historify it a little bit. Many of the writers back in the 30s and 40s certainly had strong leftist sympathies, but among the people who were involved in that group, there were a number of writers who found it although socially they gravitated to this particular group, intellectually they found their greatest pleasure in épater les gauchistes, in sort of slapping the wrists of their leftist friends, and frequently they became the most popular science fiction writers to break out of this. I'm thinking particularly of writers like Heinlein, Poole Anderson, perhaps to a somewhat lesser extent Gordon Dixon, and writers such as that. It is no accident that the crossover writers, you know, were people like Heinlein, who were gentlemen rightists socially they were gentlemen rightists in the midst of a largely left social group, but once the works did cross over, what you got basically was the conservative argument. So that was the situation in which science fiction more or less found itself at the end of the 50s, and it was only sort of with the advent of some writers towards the beginning of the 60s, Dish, Joanna Russ, Roger Zelazny, myself, Ursula Le Guin, and various and sundry others, that you began to get call any of those writers other than myself specifically leftist per se. They're certainly more liberal than not. Mm-hmm. But you get a kind of ideological sophistication in the writing is lacking in a lot of the writing before.
What's compelled you to write an autobiography? You're, 46, 47?
46. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. I suppose part of it is coming from the Stonewall generation. And Stonewall was, of course, the place at the gay bar in New York in 1968, in which when the police raided it, the client stood up to the police, and there was quite a fracas, and it was kind of the beginning of gay liberation, or at least it's frequently cited as the beginning of the most modern leg of gay liberation. And one of the things that politically came out of that is that it's very, very necessary for people to for gay people to talk about themselves, to make it clear who they were, where they were. One of the greatest threats that we had to face, that the gay community had to face up until that time, was the threat of blackmail. And it was a strange and insidious double bind. On the one hand, you have a society that says it's bad to be gay. Therefore, we will blackmail you you can't have jobs because you're a security risk. Because you're too easy to blackmail, and you know it goes around, but at the same time, you know, it's still the heterosexual world is doing the blackmailing, if you will. So it goes around and around a circle, and the only way to break out of that is to do what eventually came to be known as coming out of the closet. So I suppose since I belong to that political generation, part of the impetus for writing the book is to talk about what the reality of a certain kind of life is and was.
And a lot of the reality at that time was, I think for you, a great deal of confusion. You were married at the time to Marilyn Hacker,
yeah.
Poet.
Mm-hmm.
You were exploring the East Village homosexual life, and you were making your name as a writer. How did you keep what was going on in your mind straight?
Well, obviously I didn't. I think I get points for doing that.
Now, by didn't, what were the consequences?
Well, I think one of the things that I realized is that with each of those marginal situations, like it or not, comes a certain kind of responsibility. The responsibility is unfortunately something that is lumbered on you by the rest of society, but the responsibility, to the extent that you want to be true to yourself, requires a certain honesty and like it or not, a certain kind of bravery to stand up to the kinds of pressures that are put on you.
I have to tell you, when I go into bookstores, I'm often struck by the cover art of science fiction novels. Sometimes they're very lurid, sort of muscular scenes of men and women or of creatures in strange light. What's your reaction to cover art of science fiction novels?
Well, it's a kind of sign system in which basically the cover, at the best of times, tries to indicate to the reader what subgenre the book belongs to. And very frequently it misrepresents that subgenre, at which point we call it, bad advertising. It's interesting because the paperback field is going through a kind of change. Up until fairly recently, 6 or 7 years ago, paperback books were an item of what they used to call impulse buying. You went into the store or you passed by a bookstand, and if something caught your eye, you just bought it. But at this point, when paperback books are, the cheapest of them are $3.95, $4.50, $5.95, it's no longer an item of impulse buying, and the covers have not quite reflected this, because the covers, especially of the science fiction novels, are still being designed to appeal to the impulse buyer, when at this point most of the buyers of books are not impulse buyers anymore. They're if they're not looking for a particular book, they are going in looking for reading for a particular situation.
Well, what are some of the subgenres of science fiction? I mean, how would you make a tree of that?
Well,
you've got overall science fiction, then what comes out of that?
Well, you have hard science fiction, which tends to be science fiction with an emphasis on the science and the technology, and usually what they call a technophilic attitude. You get the impression that the characters or the author or the writer of the book likes technology. Then you have more softer sciences, where the emphasis is on sociology and psychology, or some other one of the Europeans call the human sciences. And then there's a whole range of sort of sub-fantasy categories, everything from
sword and sorcery,
mm-hmm. Yeah, which isn't really a subgenre of all of its own. Invented by a strange young man named Robert E. Howard back in the 30s.
And where do your books fit in? Where would you put yours in that category? Are they more a political?
Well, they range over the whole field, I think. Some of them, a book like Nova, is pretty much it's an adventure and pretty much a hard science novel. A book like Dahlgren, which is a very long, very soft science fiction novel. And the books that I've been working on for mostly the last 10 years, a set of stories, short novels, and indeed a couple of full-length novels in the series set in this imaginary land called Neverian. These are very much sword and sorcery stories. They really have almost no science fiction content and are more a kind of idealized historical fantasy about the beginnings of civilization and how everything that we recognize today more or less got itself going.
My guest is science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. His books include Dahlgren, Nova, and the Neverian series. He's just written a memoir titled The Motion of Light in Water. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. Do you deal with the issue of AIDS at all in your writing?
Well, yes. I have the dubious distinction of being the person who wrote the first novel-length treatment of AIDS to be published in the United States. The book was written in 1984 and published in 1985. It's part of the Neverian series. It's a novel called The Tale of Plagues and Carnivals that's contained in a book that has two short stories and a full-length novel in it called Flight from Neverian, the third volume in the Neverian series.
What did you know about AIDS at the time you wrote this book, and what was your imagination about this epidemic?
Well, at the time I wrote the book, which was basically in early part of 84, before the HTLV or HAV virus was discovered, what I was mostly interested in was the way we had a disease that at that point had afflicted only, only 4,000 or 5,000 people at the time. At that time, it seemed like a tremendous amount. One was not aware of a new disease coming along and a fatal disease slaying that many people. But one of the things that was most interesting about it to me was the fact that there was no medical reason for it. We hadn't discovered a germ, so it was catapulting everybody back into an almost medieval situation where you had a disease that, for all practical purposes, was at the time was thought to be completely fatal, and still largely is. That all of the ordinary sort of critical restraints of science were not coming into play, and it was that itself made it a terribly imaginatively volatile disease, and one that kept on sort of reaching out for strange and bizarre metaphors. It made it very easy to manipulate for all sorts of reasons that didn't have to do either with science, didn't have to do with medicine. It was connected with blood. It was connected with, perverted sex. It made it mythologically terribly volatile. And while you had voices like Susan Sontag saying that the healthy way to have a disease is not to use it for metaphors, AIDS became sort of metaphorical every time you turned around. And I was trying to explore some of the ways this was sedimenting. The actual discovery of the virus is an incident in the novel, and simply recorded off the news program, I think it was on April 24th, 1984, when it happened. And so most of the book takes place before the discovery of the virus, although it laps into the point where it becomes medicalized. Mm-hmm. But this is what the basic topic of the thing was. It's a book that takes place both in an imaginary land that is afflicted by an AIDS-like disease, and in the streets of New York, and in the subway johns of New York, and with real people, providing correspondences between the sort of imaginary world where it keeps on becoming a metaphor.
And since that time, how has AIDS affected what it is you write about?
Since that time, it's certainly become it's become one of the strands of the real world that is reflected here and there in everything. It hasn't been the central topic of a work since then, but it's certainly something that lends its, that shines its light on pretty much everything.
Well, science fiction is often used to illuminate our own time, even though it may be set in another world, in another culture. Are you able to sort of escape dealing with AIDS in this way then?
No, I don't think. Science fiction as a way to escape dealing with anything is not the best science fiction. Basically, science fiction gives you a vantage to look at and analyze what's of real concern to you in your real life. Science fiction is not about the future. Science fiction is gives you a tool where you can set up a significant dialogue with the here and now. The distortions of science fiction only uses the future as a literary convention or as a writing convention to set up some kind of dialogue with what's really going on now. So the escapist value of science fiction is, I think, only secondary to what makes it really, really of interest to us.
You've written that language can be isolating. Language sets people apart from one another in forms of categories. You write about the specific vocabulary of homosexual behavior in the East Village, and you say that you may wonder why you're writing so explicitly about some of your sexual adventures as a young man, particularly in this time of AIDS. Could you elaborate on why you do that?
Well, not too long ago, there was an interview with gay writer Harvey Fierstein in Playboy, and he made the very good point in his interview that the 60s was not the sexual revolution. What we're going through now is the sexual revolution, and AIDS indeed is a part of that. It's not necessarily the pleasantest part, but it's certainly the thing that makes the necessity for changing sexual behavior and really critiquing it in some very, very strong and realistic ways, very, very important. In terms of my book, I think it's necessary for people to know what real live people have done in order to provide pleasure for themselves. And many of these things are the kinds of things that in terms of the bourgeois heterosexual centrality seem a little strange, I think, at first. Although the various things that go on there are, you know, if one examines them closely, you know, can look pretty strange too. Nevertheless, so this is one of the things that the book is trying to do. Not so much as nostalgia, but just as analysis of some of the things that actually went on.
My guest on Fresh Air today is science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. As a young man, you had difficulty reading. You were diagnosed as being dyslexic.
Severely.
How did this come into your life for your wordplay? A lot of your writing is filled with wordplay and use of language in unorthodox ways on the page. Is this a direct reflection of your dyslexic experience?
I don't really know. Various and sundry critics have theorized on that, and most of the theorizing has felt somewhat off to me. There is the fact that a number of writers have been dyslexic, and some of the particular ones that are most well known is the French novelist Flaubert, who was known as the idiot of the family because it took him so long to learn how to read, and that's the name of the big three-volume biography that Jean-Paul Sartre wrote of Flaubert just before he died, and also William Butler Yeats, who didn't really learn how to read until he was 16. His father used to read to him endlessly, and it was only, you know, when he was in his middle teenage period that he really became comfortable reading. It's very possible that Virginia Woolf was also dyslexic. There's a good chance that Keats was. F. Scott Fitzgerald is another name that from their first drafts, there's a lot of evidence that dyslexia was present. It's intriguing that many of the writers who were dyslexics are the ones that we think of, particularly as stylists in the range of writers. And it's possible that dyslexia makes language something that you have to manipulate conscientiously rather than just let it flow. Now, on the other hand, a writer like James Joyce was as lexic as they come, I think he wrote something like a third of Ulysses in galleys, which means basically in about 2.5 months. Even in France in the 1920s, you didn't have galleys for all that long.
You were punished as a student for your terrible misspellings by being forced to go to the dictionary and look up your words. At least once.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that you were able to keep a connection with words after that experience that I would think would drive some people far away from the dictionary.
Well, again, paradoxically, frequently dyslexics are highly verbal people. Not necessarily, though. I have a number of friends, for instance, who are dyslexics who just weren't blessed with the, you know, just weren't, didn't have the good fortune to start off with a high IQ. Dyslexia has nothing to do with basic intelligence, and this is one of the things it's kind of hard to make clear to people. A dyslexic may, you know, be very, very bright. A dyslexic may be perfectly normal in intelligence, or a dyslexic may be, you know, subnormal. It affects something like 1 out of 10 males. Like color blindness, it's sexual, it's hereditary and sexually linked. But as I said, I have some friends who are dyslexic who with perfectly normal, you know, intelligence whom it hurt a great deal more than it did me, simply because I had available a certain number of strategies to get around it. And that's basically what one has to do. There isn't really an overcoming it. You just develop ways to compensate.
Well, Samuel Delaney, thank you very much for coming in.
Okay, thank you very much, Seth.
Samuel Delaney's new memoir is titled The Motion of Light on Water, Sex and Science Fiction Writing in the East Village. It's published by Arbor House. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Irwin Winkler. His low-budget regional boxing film, Rocky, turned into a Hollywood phenomenon and led to Rockies 2 through 4. He continues to produce smaller independent releases, including Raging Bull, The Right Stuff, Round Midnight, and the new Costa Gavras film, Betrayed. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. President Kennedy was assassinated nearly 25 years ago, but novelist Don DeLillo still feels influenced by the killing. His novels deal with government cover-ups and public distrust. DeLillo's new novel imagines a web of fate and coincidence surrounding the assassination. Coming up, we meet Don DeLillo. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the late Eddie Cochran. Relatively few rock fans in this country remember that Cochran was a star in the late 50s, but Ed says in England, he's still going strong. And guest book critic Stuart Klawans reviews two works by African novelist Amos Tutuola. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The United Nations Security Council has formally approved the 350-member Iran-Iraq Observer Group, known as UNIMOG. The team should be in place by the time the official ceasefire starts on August 20th. NPR's Anne Garrels has this report.
UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar says the peacekeeping force will cost $74 million just for the first 6 months. But the UN coffers are virtually empty because some members, including the United States, have failed to pay their dues. And UN members will have to create a special peacekeeping fund. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the U.S. is urging Iran and Iraq's neighbors, as well as those countries like Japan who get their oil from the region, to cover at least half the total with voluntary contributions. Under UN rules, the U.S. will have to pay 31% of the balance left. Administration officials say the U.S. will pay its share. Perez de Cuellar has recruited the 350-man force from 25 countries. As a permanent member of the Security Council, the U.S. has not been asked to contribute any forces, but the administration has said it will help with transportation. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The House today gave final congressional approval to a $3.9 billion drought relief bill. The Senate has already passed the measure, and the White House said today that President Reagan will sign the bill soon. The bill is the most expensive disaster relief measure ever passed. It provides emergency aid to farmers, livestock producers, and dairy farmers. The Federal Reserve Board today raised its key discount rate a half point to 6.5%. The increase lifted the rate back to its level of more than 2 years ago, and it's the strongest action taken this year by the Fed to keep the economy from overheating and to reduce inflationary pressure. The White House expressed disappointment with the discount rate increase, but said there were sound reasons for the action, which it portrayed as a temporary blip. President Reagan named Lauro Cavazos as his nominee to succeed William Bennett as Education Secretary today. Bennett is stepping down next month. If confirmed, Cavazos will become the first Hispanic cabinet member. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Campaigning in Texas last month, Vice President Bush promised to appoint a Hispanic cabinet member if elected president. Today, he was beaten to the punch by President Reagan, who named the 61-year-old son of a ranch foreman as his third Secretary of Education. Cavazos has served as president of Texas Tech University since 1980. President Reagan denied today that Cavazos was chosen because of his ethnic heritage.
I selected him because He seemed to be the best-fitted man to follow Mr. Bennett.
In fact, Cavazos is a Democrat, according to White House officials, who also say he was considered as President Reagan's original education secretary in 1980, but withdrew from consideration. The selection of Cavazos illustrates the importance given to Hispanic voters in this election year and to the state of Texas. Democratic nominee Michael Dukakis has selected a Texan as his running mate, who, like himself, speaks fluent Spanish. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
Hockey star Wayne Gretzky has been traded from the Edmonton Oilers to the Los Angeles Kings. Two other Oilers players will also go to L.A. The Kings give up a center, their top draft pick, three future draft choices, and an undisclosed amount of money, reported to be between $10 and $20 million. Speculation about a possible trade has been growing since Gretzky married actress Janet Jones, who lives in Los Angeles. He has been voted the NHL's most valuable player 8 times in 9 seasons, and he led the Oilers to 4 Stanley Cup titles in the past 5 years. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 28 points today to close at 2079.13. Declines led advances 4-1 on volume of 201 million shares. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If American rock and roller Eddie Cochran had lived out the decade of the 60s, his music might have made a big difference in pop music here. As it was, he put hits on the charts from time to time, but his success in this country never lasted. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward tells us Cochran has always been revered across the Atlantic.
The best television commercial I've seen all year was in England. It was one of those legendary British Levi's ads that takes an old rock and roll song and weaves an atmospheric story around it. Unlike the others in the series, though, this one is based on fact. It dealt with the night Sharon Sheely met Eddie Cochran. It just pointed up another difference between Britain and the U.S. You couldn't use Eddie Cochran's name to sell pants over here, even though he's worshipped as a god in Britain. Eddie Cochran was born in Albert Lea, Minnesota, but he was of good old Oklahoma stock. In 1953, when he was 15, his family moved to Bell Gardens near Los Angeles, and in order to make friends, Eddie started a little band with him on guitar. He soon attracted the attention of Hank Cochran, no relation, who was beginning a songwriting career and needed somebody to play with. And then, one day in a music store, Eddie ran into another songwriter, Jerry Capehart. The three of them messed around with various country tunes, and soon Hank Cochran left for Nashville. But Eddie and Capehart had been hooked by rock and roll, and late in 1955, they went into a studio and cut a tune called Skinny Jim.
Well, I know God was deep on his skin, but they raving about
This was intended mostly as a demo record to show what Eddie and Jerry could do, and with it they made the rounds of the record companies. It was good timing. Everybody was looking to cash in on rock and roll, and in Hollywood, an Oklahoma boy with teenage good looks and a big guitar was just what they were after. Eddie signed a deal with Liberty Records and almost immediately was offered a small part in one of the finest rock and roll movies ever, The Girl Can't Help It. In the film, which is in color, Eddie's in black and white, playing a song called 20 Flight Rock on a television program.
Well, I gotta get with a record machine when it comes to rock, and she's the queen. We'll love to dance on a Saturday night. All alone where I can hold her tight, but she lives on the 20th floor of town. The elevator's broken down, so I walk 1, 5, 3, 5, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 flight more. Up on the 12th, I'm starting to drag. 50 feet before, I'm already to sag. Get to the top, I'm too tired to ride.
The movie, along with another song, Sitting in the Balcony, which didn't sound much like him, launched Eddie's career.
I'm just sitting in the balcony, just watching a movie, or maybe it's a symphony, I wouldn't know. I don't care about the symphony, those are cymbals and the timpani. I'm just sitting in the balcony, on the very last row, I'll hold your hand.
But the bad news was, by the end of 1956, there were lots of cute 18-year-olds with good hair and big guitars, and although Eddie and Jerry Capehart worked hard at it, it seemed like they couldn't hit anything. On the other hand, spending most of 1957 trying to come up with a hit had its bright side. Eddie and Jerry worked together with one of the first multi-track machines, and although Eddie performed with a band, most of his records are just him and Capehart, overdubbed several times. That was the case with the song they came up with in the spring of 1958. It was written in 45 minutes, and both of them knew Summertime Blues was a classic.
Son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
And this time, they had a follow-up all planned, a song that kept Eddie Cochran's name in the public ear for the rest of the year. Come on, everybody. So what if it sounded a lot like the previous hit? It sold, and Eddie toured, meeting a guy with whom he had a lot in common, Buddy Holly. They formed a close bond, and Eddie was supposed to have been on the Winter Dance Party tour with Buddy, but canceled at the last minute. Horrified by Buddy's death, he recorded a song called Three Stars that was supposed to benefit the families of the plane crash victims, but the record company wouldn't let him release it. At a New Year's Eve party, Eddie met Sharon Sheely, a songwriter, and they immediately became inseparable. Sharon co-wrote Eddie's last great record, Something Else, which, for some reason, wasn't a hit.
Oh, look at there. Here she comes. Here comes that girl again. Wanted to meet her since I don't know when. But she don't notice me when I pass. She goes with older guys from out of my class. But that can't stop me from thinking to myself. She's your fine looking man. She's something else.
Sharon accompanied him on his tour of England in the spring when a teenage George Harrison followed the tour just to watch Eddie's fingers, and the rest of England turned out to see Eddie and his co-star, Gene Vincent. Did Eddie awaken screaming in the middle of the night on April 17, 1960? That's part of the legend. Were he and Sharon flying back to the States to be married? That's another part. All we know for sure was that a limo with Eddie, Sharon, and Gene Vincent blew a tire at high speed and plowed into a lamppost. Sharon and Gene were badly hurt. Eddie suffered massive head injuries and never recovered. Britain had had its first taste of American rock and roll, and it had ended in tragedy. Eddie Cochran had become the first rock and roll fatality of the 60s and a legend in his time.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll.
Richie, you were just starting to realize your dreams. Everyone calls me a kid. You were only 17. Now Almighty God has called you.
Three Stars on Fresh Air. Novelist Don DeLillo doesn't like to talk about his writing. He says most of his novels tend to be elusive and abstract. But he will talk about his new novel, Libra, he says, because Libra is grounded in reality, the assassination of President Kennedy. All DeLillo's novels examine the defoliation of the American scene in settings from the worlds of advertising to rock music, football, science, and terrorism. DeLillo is best known for his novel White Noise, which won the 1985 American Book Award. White Noise is a comic and terrifying tale of technology and death as told through the voice of the chair of the Department of Hitler Studies at a small liberal arts college. While writing White Noise, DeLillo wrote a nonfiction essay for Rolling Stone about the Kennedy assassination, which led him to further explore the events of 1963. Although we know the outcome of the story that unfolds in his new book, Libra, DeLillo says that too much has been left to speculation.
We don't know the details of the story. We don't know what the characters were thinking. We don't know some of the links between characters. These are the gaps I tried to fill in. Beyond that, I think a work of fiction that resolves some of the unanswered questions may be one way for people to soften the edges of their dissatisfaction with the past. There's a sense in which fiction can rescue history from its confusions.
What was it about Lee Harvey Oswald that fascinated you as a writer?
Well, probably the fact that he was an outsider, the fact that he harbored contradictions. He was double-dealing, self-pitying, violent, cruel. But he was also battered by his attempts to make his way in the world. I think he was the classic Libran, at least in theory. He leaned one way, but ended up acting another. He tilted one way, ended up acting another.
In the book, you make him a very sympathetic character, and perhaps that's just because we see him more as a human being than just a figure being shot in a hallway.
Well, that's all it is. I tried to portray the man as completely as I possibly could, and I tried to stay as close to the real Oswald as I understood him to be. If he's sympathetic, perhaps the reader is supplying this emotion. I try to be as even-handed as possible. Certainly, Oswald is no victim. He's the gunman.
But he also seems, in many ways, allowing himself to be pushed around. You talk about, I get the sense, destiny is a cop-out. You know, if we make that green light, if you get in, then you must act, you must shoot, otherwise you're not destined to do it. That seems to be a thought that goes through Lee Oswald's mind and through Jack Ruby's mind and even some of the CIA characters you've created.
Well, I think there is a strong element of passivity in Oswald's makeup. I think there is a point at which he stopped trying to exert his influence on his immediate surroundings and simply waited for whatever would happen. And I think this may have been an element in his decision to shoot at the president. I think the motivating force was the sheer coincidence of the fact that the president's motorcade would be passing beneath his window, and exactly at the time when he was most likely to be alone on the sixth floor. This must have been a powerful influence on his decision to take his rifle to work that day.
What was the nature of the research that you did? There's a character in your stories, Nicholas Branch, a retired CIA man who's writing a secret history. He talks about being overwhelmed with paper slipping out the door. There are details. There's minutia. Was that Don DeLillo writing this book?
Well, to a limited extent. The main source of my work was the Warren Report, the summary volume and the 26 accompanying volumes of testimony and exhibits. And together they comprise a kind of encyclopedia of daily life. Dental records, postcards, report cards, old newspapers. They're very evocative, not only of the period, the late 50s and early 60s, but of many of the people who are part of the assassination archives.
Well, in many ways, did this make your research as a novelist easier? You didn't have to make up details? I mean, all the details were right there?
Yes. The details did drive the work. They provided a sense of propulsion to my day-to-day routine. There's no doubt about it.
You described the assassination as 7 seconds that broke the back of the century. Could you explain, what did that do for your writing, too, that date in 1963?
In some ways, it's possible that single event made me the kind of writer I turned out to be. Certainly, I was not a fully formed writer at that stage. I was 26 or 27 years old and had only published some short stories and small quarterlies. As time went by and as I began to find my voice as a writer, I began to realize it was something of a dark voice and that my books had a dark tone. I don't think it's out of the question that the assassination, in part at least, was responsible for this. And so, in a sense, I suppose, Libra is a culmination for me.
You've written or said somewhere that paranoia seems to be the most reasonable approach to life in our times. Do you live your life that way?
No, I'm not paranoid at all. I can't conceive of writing a book about the assassination without recognizing the element of paranoia which seems to have entered our lives as a result of that 7 seconds. What seems missing in the past 25 years is the sense of a coherent reality most of us shared. We seem to have entered a world of paranoia and ambiguity and randomness. A character in the book calls this an aberration in the heartland of the real. Even after all these years, we're not agreed on the number of gunmen, the number of shots, the origin of the shots, the paths the bullets took, the number of wounds on the president's body, and the list goes on and on. Beyond this, I think we've developed a sense of the secret manipulation of history. Documents lost or destroyed, official records sealed for 25 or 50 years, a number of very suggestive murders and suicides.
And what about your private thoughts, sort of in the middle of the night as you were working on the project? Would you begin to dream of these people?
I thought about them all the time. I still think about them, particularly Oswald himself. And he certainly entered my consciousness. I don't think I'll ever get rid of him, really. He's stuck to me for life.
In part of Libra, you describe the intersection that Oswald and Kennedy have, that eventually these lines will cross. Your line seems to have been a third one.
Well, it's odd, but Lee Oswald and I lived 6 or 7 blocks from each other in the Bronx in 1953. He and his mother traveled to New York because his oldest brother, actually his half-brother, was stationed at Ellis Island with the Coast Guard. And so they lived near the Bronx Zoo for about a year at the same time that I lived just a short distance away. He was 13 years old at the time, and I was 16.
So you feel a chronological closeness, a proximity to him?
Not exactly, but the very coincidence gave me a kind of personal nudge toward doing the book.
You seem to want to step aside from the whole literary world of selling and of merchandising books, and you release a book to the world, and then you go back and write in privacy again from within your room. That was one thing that struck me about Oswald. He was always coming back down to one small room, a small closet.
I suppose that's one reason why I was interested in Oswald. He seemed to live his life in small, cramped rooms. And in fact, this is a theme which runs through my work. There seems to be someone confronting himself in a room somewhere in all my novels. And I found it interesting that I would eventually come upon a real person who lived that same kind of pared-down existence I had created for purely fictional characters.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Don DeLillo's new book, Libra, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up later from National Public Radio, and co-host Robert Siegel is with me on the line in Washington. What's in the news today?
Well, in the news, we have an increase in interest rates, and we also have a new Secretary of Education, as Secretary Bennett has announced his resignation with the president. It's a friendly resignation. We also, though, have a special report tonight. It's an obituary of Archie Harrison. Regular listeners to All Things Considered will know Archie as the AIDS patient whom we followed now for more than a year through his illness, through his treatment with AZT, and finally his going off of that medication and facing his death over the past several months. Today, the last of the Archie pieces.
Sounds like a compelling program
today,
Bob. Thanks. You can hear all those stories and more coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Nowadays, when people talk about the literature of Black Africa, they're probably referring to Wale Soyinka and Chinua Achebe. But before them, there was Amos Tutuola, a Nigerian who writes in English. His stories read as if they were first told around a campfire. It's hard to find copies of his novels, but two have just been reissued. Guest book critic Stuart Kloans has these thoughts on Tutuola's work.
Here's how Amos Tutuola describes one of his typical characters, the satyr of the dark jungle. He was about 10 feet tall and very strong, bold and vigorous. His head was full of dirty long hairs, and the hairs were full up with refuses and dried leaves. The mouth was so large and wide that it almost covered the nose. The eyes were so fearful that a person could not be able to look at them for two times, especially the powerful illumination they were bringing out always. He wore plenty of juju beads around his neck. The spider's webs were spread over his mouth, and this showed that he had not eaten for a long time. This satyr was a pessimist. He was impatient and ill-tempered, impenitent and noxious creature. His beard was so long and bushy that it was touching the ground, and he was using it for sweeping his house as if it was a broom. I wanted to read you this passage so you'd have some idea of Amos Tutuola's style. He writes in a sorcerer's apprentice English, full of magically improbable turns of phrase, artfully jumbled constructions, borrowings and inventions, and flat-out mistakes. From the time he first came into prominence, his style has been the main attraction of his books, that and the strange and wonderful events he relates. In Tutuola's books, you can follow the adventures of Simbi, a rich girl who foolishly ignores her mother's advice and thereby reaps many punishments. For starters, she's captured by a slave trader. Then she's offered as a human sacrifice, pursued by one of her friends who's been turned into a chicken, and even married, though that part of it happens pretty much in passing. Or you can hear about the journeys of an old village chief, from his run-in with the jungle witch to his narrow escape from the hairy giant and his wife, the hairy giantess. All of this and Tutuola's untutored style have drawn in thousands of readers. But there has been a problem. T.S. Eliot was the person who got Tutuola into print. And given Eliot's view of the world, I think we have every reason to be suspicious. Eliot was to cultural snobism as Ed Meese is now to sleaze. So why would Eliot promote Tutuola? What are some of the words that suggest themselves rather too easily to describe Tutuola's writing? Naive, childlike, primitive. Tutuola's English delighted Eliot, but I think it also provided him with evidence that Africans are simple-minded, very convenient and very wrong. Yet that kind of thinking still dominates the discussion. It's more subtle now, but it's still there. So let's appreciate Tutuola for the right reasons, the ones that make him singular rather than representative. City Lights has republished Simbi and the Satyr of the Dark Jungle, a novel from 1955, and Feather Woman of the Jungle from 1962. Let's simply say that the writing is fresh, the sort of vivid, quirky, thoroughly unexpected prose that makes a story seem timeless. It's just the right style for the fantastic goings-on. I can guarantee you will be entertained, and you'll discover many useful morals as well. You can't ask for much more than that.
Stuart Kloans writes about small press fiction and poetry for The Nation magazine. He reviewed the work of Amos Tutuola, and I'll spell the author's name, Tutuola. Here's a look at tomorrow's show. On tomorrow's show, I speak with Louisiana-born guitar maker Danny Farrington. His custom-made acoustic guitars are played and prized by musicians such as Waylon Jennings, Elvis Costello, Eric Clapton, and Leo Kottke. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of a historic 1940 concert at the Library of Congress, featuring composer and pianist Béla Bartók and violinist Joseph Zaghetti. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Deborah Beagle, and Becky Thorne. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.